Today in Studio 360, okay, crime doesn't pay, but writing about crime can work out great. The mystery novelist Sue Grafton has been producing her Alphabet series of novels for more than 30 years, and she's only got two left, Y and Z. After that?
After that, I will be close to 80 years old, and I personally think I should be allowed to take a long nap and then party.
And the art forger Mark Landis says that once he fooled his first art collector, he just couldn't stop making fake artworks.
Everybody was just so nice and treated me with respect and deference and friendship, things I was very unused to at all. I got addicted to it.
I'm Kurt Anderson. We've got a whole hour of crime ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first, my father was a great reader of fiction, most voraciously of crime fiction, mystery novels. His one significant home improvement my whole life was adding about 60 feet of bookshelves devoted to his detective novels. And as a kid, I remember noticing that a surprising share of those authors were women. Agatha Christie, P.D. James, and then in the last decade of his life, Martha Grimes, and Sue Grafton. 33 years ago, Sue Grafton published A is for Alibi, then B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse, all starring a tomboyish private detective named Kinsey Millhone. And then, starting around G is for Gumshoe, they all became huge bestsellers. I talked with Sue Grafton after she'd published a series of short stories about her main character called Kinsey and Me. Kinsey is not exactly her alter ego, but they do share some things in common.
Well, when I began this series in 1982, she was 32 years old. She has been married and divorced twice. She owns one dress. She cuts her hair with a pair of nail scissors, cusses like a soldier, very down to earth, and has a very wicked eye when it comes to observing human nature.
So she's kind of an every woman, except that she runs several miles every day and solves crimes.
She jogs. It isn't running. Even she would admit that. But she eats a lot of junk food, which I can no longer do myself.
When the first one came out in the early 80s, it was kind of a big deal because your detective was this woman, this young, tough, modern woman. Did you have a sense as you embarked on this that the time was ripe and maybe overripe for such a detective in fiction?
No, I can't claim any prescience. I can't claim I was even aware. I just didn't realize there were no female private investigators. I was raised reading male hard-boiled private detectives. So when it came time to write a mystery novel, a crime novel of my own, my only thought was to play the central part myself. Because I was already out of my element. I didn't know what a private investigator did. I had to read up on police procedure and California criminal law and ballistics and toxicology. So I figured my only area of expertise was being female, and I better take advantage.
You started writing the Kinsey Millhone novels as a means, I read, to escape a successful career in TV writing, which is usually with the opposite of how it usually goes, where people who can't make money writing novels say, okay, I'm going to go into show business now. But you didn't like making a lot of money in Hollywood.
No. Well, I had done a stint in Hollywood because my second published novel, which is called The Lolly Madonna War, sold to Hollywood, and that was made into a film that came out in 1973. Fabulous cast. It was Rod Steiger and Robert Ryan. And
the young Jeff Bridges, right?
Yes, indeed. It was really a wonderful cast. It was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot in Hollywood, but I am just not a team player. I do not like to write by committee, and I don't like help. So in Hollywood, if you're not interested in collaboration, you just have no business being there, and it took me a while to figure that out.
Whereas writing novels, you are in control. You're the screenwriter. You're the director. You're everything.
I know, which is good news and the bad. when the work is going well, there's nothing better. When I'm stuck, I wouldn't mind having a small committee at my feet to help me through the rough passages.
There has never been an American TV series or movie version of Kinsey Mill Hone. How come?
Oh, well, for the very reason I just detailed. I worked in Hollywood for 15 years, and I was guilty of adaptations, probably trashing the work of writers far better than I. I know what they can do. I know how destructive that system can be. For one thing, the first time that character is cast and an actress steps into that role, half my readers will be outraged, and I will also. Plus, they don't buy a book, they buy the rights to the character. And even in 1982, here's how those contracts read. They buy a character throughout the universe in perpetuity in technologies known and technologies yet to be invented. It's like, don't think so.
So you leave that money on the table knowing you're paying some financial price, but...
It's no price at all. I tell you, my peace of mind and my good nature are worth quite a bit of money. I just don't want that system coming after me.
This new book, Kinsey and Me, has nine stories about Kinsey and a dozen or so highly autobiographical stories that you wrote many years ago in your 20s.
Yes.
These non-Kinsey stories, these ones you wrote when you were practically a kid, what made you want to publish them now?
My husband did a limited printing of these stories, the whole collection, in 1991. Of late, with social media being what it is, I've got readers clamoring, and I know it's a bold word, of really pressing me to do additional publishing. And since this book was largely finished, I thought it might be a good idea to give it a commercial airing.
This A is for B is for C is for thing was clearly a brilliant scheme to invent to start out with 30 years ago. Have you regretted it ever along the way of, oh, my God, I got to get to Z?
In some respects, looking back, I think what nerve, what cheek I had at the age of late 30s when I started that book, thinking I could do 26 novels.
Yeah.
For one thing, I had not even sold A is for Alibi. I sold that book on the basis of 65 pages. Never having written a mystery in my life, so I was flying by the seat of my pants. And when A was published, I had no guarantee that there would be a B is for burglar, let alone C is for corpse, D is for deadbeat, and on down the line.
And how sad it would have been if you'd ended with E or F.
Exactly. I was happy to get through those letters. I was always waiting for them to say F is for failure. So yeah. I was really happy.
D is for
when
done.
In fact, there was a review of B is for burglar that said B is for boring. And I thought I would faint. However, I did survive that wicked comment.
So of the 22 previous ones, by my count, 20 of them have been nouns and two of them have been adjectives, which are I is for innocent and L is for lawless. And I was thinking, what could W be? Maybe wicked, or maybe you just want to tell me.
I will not tell. For one thing, readers have so much fun trying to guess. And as a minute I shoot off my big mouth, somebody's going to be disappointed. But also, I have changed my mind on many occasions. When I thought K was for kidnap, so I blithely set off down that wrong path. And at a certain point, I realized that Kinsey Mill Hone is a small-time private eye. Kidnapping is a federal crime, and trust me, the FBI is never going to consult her. So I had to toss pages of notes, chapters of the book, and I came up with the title K is for Killer because I thought, well, that'll cover a multitude of sins. Doesn't matter what kind of storyline I come up with, it's bound to be applicable.
I really don't envy you having to come up with X and Z.
I know. X, see, I am hoping that by the time I write X, somebody will invent an entirely new crime. I hope it's going to be really good and juicy and nasty. And then I can just set out on that road.
Maybe. Well, there's some drugs, you know, Xanax or...
Yeah, you know. Xanax, like the killer Xanax.
So in you know, 3 years, you're going to be done. Do you have plans for post-Kinsey Millhone novels, or is that it?
It's going to be 8 years. It's been taking me 2 years per book. So when I get to X, I'll start that in 8 months after I get out of the institution they check me into for finishing this book, you know, after I get my meds adjusted. And I don't know what X is. I don't have a clue. I know even less about Y and Z, but surely something will occur to me between now and then. And after that, I will be close to 80 years old, and I personally think I should be allowed to take a long nap and then party.
There you go. So like Philip Roth, you're gonna call it quits at 80.
I don't think so, because I don't know what else I would do with my life. I agonize through these books, and I pray, it's like every day, please let me get to the end of this book. Then I get to the end of the book, and I have about 4 days of wild freedom. I can go to the grocery store like at 10 in the morning. And after I do that for about 3 days, I think, this is so boring. You know, it's like life has no meaning and no purpose, so I have to come back to my machine.
So I guess it's like Dr. Johnson in London. When you're tired of writing, you're tired of life, and you're not tired of life yet.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Sue Grafton, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.
I talked with Sue Grafton 2 years ago, and that novel has been just published this month. Turns out she went with X, period. It doesn't stand for anything except maybe marking the spot. A few weeks ago, we launched a new chapter in our series of redesign projects. In the past, we've imagined new incarnations of the gay rainbow flag, the national anthem, and Christmas. Our latest idea comes after the Confederate flag has been removed from public buildings and taken out of stores. We wanted to figure out if it's possible to come up with some new symbol for the South. Maybe not a flag at all, but a piece of iconography that celebrates the region's history and culture without the ugliness. So we asked the design firm 70KFT in Dallas to come up with this symbol for the South, and we asked you for your input too.
I'm Susan Scher of Owings Mills, Maryland. I went to school in the South, and I was told that the pineapple was the Southern symbol of hospitality. I saw it in architecture and furniture, so why can't that be the Southern symbol of welcome?
This is Angela Sanders. I was born in South Carolina. I think it's time to stop differentiating the South from the rest of our country. We are one country. There's not a symbol for the Northeast, the Midwest, or the West. Why should the South continue to be separated? Time to join the fold, boys and girls.
My name is Rob Solowitz. I'm in New York. Any proposed alternative should be a symbol that can be embraced by a wide variety of people as having an exclusively positive value. I believe that object is the guitar. Consider its magnificent variety of expression: Mississippi blues, Appalachian folk, bluegrass, rockabilly, jazz, mariachi, even heavy metal, alternative pop. The guitar has never been a tool of oppression. On the contrary, it is the vessel of countless songs, songs forever associated with American Southern cultures, of human desire and hope, of cries for freedom and justice.
All good thoughts, and please keep letting us know what you think on our Facebook page or at studio360.org. And a few weeks from now, we'll check in with the design team in Dallas to see what they've come up with. Up next, an amazing art forger who fooled dozens of museum curators for decades and who turns out to be not as meticulous as you'd think.
I've got to get things done really fast, a movie starts on TV, and I like to have it done by the time the movie's over.
The weird hobby of Mark Landis is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. We're looking today at all kinds of crime. For the last 30 years, Yola Tengo has been swiping other people's songs again and again. One of their specialties is making interesting, really brilliant cover versions, like the great one they did right here in Studio 360 of the classic song by The Cure, Friday I'm in Love.
Thursday, never looking back, it's Friday, I'm in love.
And now we've asked all of you to choose Yola Tengo's next cover song. It can be any tune, no rules whatsoever. Tweet your requests using the hashtag YolaCovers or post your requests on Twitter using the hashtag YolaCovers, or you can leave us a comment at studio360.org. When it comes to art forgers, not many that I can think of have been more prolific than Mark Landis.
46 museums in 20 states with more than 100 pieces that he's offered up to these institutions.
Landis made scores of drawings and paintings of all sorts, from lesser-known artists to Picasso and Walt Disney. But here's the interesting part. He never tried to sell his forgeries. He donated them. And he fooled museums all over the country into accepting his gifts. Until in 2007, one of them finally looked the gift horse in the mouth. At the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, the registrar got suspicious. And he, a guy named Matthew Leininger, started an investigation that led to Landis's exposure. It's one of the most curious forgery cases in art history. Because Landis never received a penny for his forgeries, he's never been prosecuted. He and the unraveling of his 30-year con are the subject of a fascinating documentary called Art and Craft by the filmmaker Sam Coleman. So, Sam Coleman and Mark Landis, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us.
So, Mark, watching this documentary, it was so surprising to me both how quickly you work and do these pictures and the incredibly common materials you use. Like, you were buying stuff at Hobby Lobby to forge apparently convincing Picassos. Talk about your process and the tools.
Oh, sure. Well, all that really counts is what it looks like, you know. When you go to a museum, you don't put it under one of those giant microscopes.
No, but you expect the museums to.
That they have down in the basement of museums. And I've been in plenty of them.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, when you meet people, you don't x-ray them or anything, right? It's like a magic trick. Let's put it, that's a good, it's like a magic trick.
Right.
Yeah, if it looks convincing.
Except, never believe that a magician is really performing magic.
Yeah, you're right. That was a bad one.
That's all right. I want to talk about the stuff you use, though. I mean, you're shown using felt-tip pens and putting, like, crappy dime store frames on them.
I like things that are easy, because if there is such a thing as attention deficit disorder, I've got it, because I've got to get things done really fast. A movie starts on TV, and I like to have it done by the time the movie's over, you know.
Really? So, really, a picture takes you only a couple of few hours?
Yeah, at best.
How did you learn to do it?
Well, I grew up in Europe in the 60s, and mother and dad used to like to travel around.
And he was a naval officer, right?
That's right. He worked for NATO. Anyway, we'd, you know, go to museums during the day and of course, we'd bring back catalogs and things, and then they liked to go out, and I'd be left alone in a hotel room, and they didn't have TVs in the hotel rooms yet,
right.
But I did have the catalogs to go through, and like all kids, you know, you draw pictures, and I started copying pictures out of the catalogs.
So once you decided, hey, I'm going to do these and give them away to museums, how did you and how do you decide what works to forge?
Oh, okay. Well, to begin with, it was an impulse way back in 85 or 86. And everybody was just so nice and treated me with respect and deference and friendship, things I was—
Because they thought you were rich and generous.
Yeah, things I was very unused to.
Right,
I mean, actually not used to at all. And I got addicted to it. And to answer the second part of your question, okay, before I subscribed to the internet and everything, I had to rely on the museum directory at the library. The main thing is you try and find out a little bit about the museum and what they collect, because you have to give them something they want, you know, something that they specifically collect.
And then once you decide, okay, this is the kind of thing they want, do you say, oh, I love this picture? Or is it all about making the—
No, you have to find well, preferably find something that you like doing, but the main thing is something that they will want, you know.
Right. And so for 20 years as you did this, nobody ever said, wait, we got to check this out, or I'm not sure.
Well, no, they did. But what I cared about was that they didn't get around to doing it until I was long gone.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess if they ever were suspicious, they would probably keep it quiet, since it's no— – they didn't pay anything for it.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. I mean, I do have a collection of stiff letters. But
what does stiff letters mean?
Oh, just, you know, the usual thing. Thank you very much for your interest in our museum. We have decided to deaccession such and such and remove it from our permanent collection. You know, that sort of— that's what I mean, sincerely. That's a stiff letter.
Sam, when you tracked Mark down to Mississippi and told him you were working on this documentary, as I understand it, he immediately said he spilled the beans, right? And showed you how he does it.
Well, it wasn't immediate. Mark spent some time vetting us on the phone. But you're right. It's true. When we met Mark with camera in tow, he was incredibly forthcoming for a guy in his position. He wanted to tell us everything, and he let us film him making the copies and eventually, pretty soon thereafter, giving them away.
And was that, Mark, because you thought, okay, this has gone on long enough. This is a new fun piece of this adventure?
No. Actually, it's like most things. There's always a simple answer. I'm a lonely old shut-in, and I really appreciated
attention.
Having some chic young filmmakers from New York City come to spend some time with me and become friends to me.
Sam, the film also follows Matthew Leininger, who is the registrar, was the registrar at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, who first got suspicious about Mark's donations. The New York Times describes Matt Leininger as the Javert to Mark's Jean Valjean, the police inspector and thief from Les Miserables. I definitely see the Javert in Leininger. But since Mark is a career deceiver, I mean, isn't he more like a, I don't know, Dostoevsky character or something? I mean, because he's not an innocent.
No, Mark's not an innocent. I think he will eventually take responsibility for what he's done in conversation. But, you know, I do think what is remarkable about Mark and what made his story so intriguing to us is that I don't think there was malice in his actions. You know, when we first met him, he was genuinely upset to hear that he had caused people some anguish.
So why do you think Matt Leininger picked up on this thing that all these dozens of experts for years and years had not?
Well, Mark is remarkable for many, many reasons. One of them is that as a forger, he copies a huge range of things. He's made copies from 15th century icons all the way to Picasso and Walt Disney and everything in between. That's unusual for people who make copies. The other thing that is unusual that Mark did, which also I think resulted in Matt finding him out, is that he made multiple copies of the same work and gave them to the different places across the country. And by the time the internet age came about, Matt, when he received one of the gifts, looked it up and found out, hey, that's in a couple other institutions. There's something wrong here.
And because he didn't sell them, because he donated them, that's explains why he's here rather than in jail, I guess.
That's right. Mark walks free.
And when you were doing this, were you conscious of the legal issues and, oh, if I just give them away, I'll never get in trouble?
I guess I just didn't really think about it much.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
I mean, I'd have known that if I was selling, because I've seen enough TV. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, I didn't think I'd get into trouble. No,
right.
I thought they'd just get mad and
right.
Send stiff letters and And I'd be long gone by the time they got mad, so, you know.
And so you concocted all these false identities as the philanthropist in these various museums, but you also donated works using your own name.
Oh, yeah, I started out doing that, yeah. But then when I thought gossip was getting around, because you know what they say about things being this business is a small world. Everybody knows everybody in this business. So I was afraid gossip was getting around.
Uh-huh.
So I thought I had better start using different aliases and things.
We see you in the film going to see mental health professionals and talking about your various diagnoses for schizophrenia and other things. Do you ever think of this adventure, these forgeries, as some symptom of illness or not?
I never thought of it in that way, no. And I don't even know if any of that stuff's wrong with me.
At what point, Sam, in the making of the film, did you become aware of this history of quote-unquote mental illness, and did that change the way you were thinking about Mark and his story?
Definitely, many of those things. So we were introduced to the story actually through Matt Leininger. When the Times wrote the piece that inspired Jennifer to contact me and to go out and try and make this film, they had not talked to Mark yet. They described him as at large, sort of trumping up the dramatic aspects of him being this big bad guy out there in the world. And by the time we tracked down Matt, Matt was speculating a lot about, there had been rumors, you know, is Mark ill? Is he dangerous? You know, there was like a lot of like fear about that. And of course, when we got to meet Mark, none of that was really accurate. But we did get Mark to talk about his family, his past, and also his mental illness. And that certainly did change what we thought we had. You know, the film sort of starts off as this art caper, a cat and mouse chase, and then it becomes something much broader, I think, once we learn who Mark is.
So a couple of years ago, there was a show of your work in Cincinnati organized by the University of Cincinnati and by Matt Leininger, who busted you, called Faux Real. Now there's this big documentary that we're talking about here. This has all panned out pretty well for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, door of opportunity opens both ways. Because I remember when, you know, I first found out I was in trouble, I was pretty down because I was thinking, gee, what am I going to do? You know, I can't just sit around in my room watching TV the rest of my life, you know? I mean.
Yeah. So this must be fun.
Now? Yeah. Well, yes, so far, yeah.
Are you still making pictures?
Yeah. People have been letting me do their grandchildren and children. And when they go on a vacation, like to Europe, they bring back things and they want paintings of. And then, you know, the churches in Laurel have had me do things for benefit auctions, which gives you a boost, you know, to your self-esteem.
Right.
Yeah.
Still doing forgeries, though?
Oh, no.
No?
No, not unless somebody asks me to.
Right. Yeah. You're not deceiving anyone?
No, not really.
Or so you claim.
Not really.
Not really?
No more than anybody else.
Well, Mark, it has been a pleasure talking to you, and good luck with how you spend this incredibly active retirement.
Thank you for everything.
And Sam Coleman, thank you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Art and Craft is the documentary about Mark Landis, and if you'd like to see some of his forgeries, go to studio360.org. We love hearing from listeners about works of art and entertainment that have changed their lives somehow. We got an email from Jonathan Amsbury about a TV show he loved as a kid in the 1960s featuring a certain criminal defense attorney who never seemed to lose a case.
One of my favorite shows at the time was Perry Mason, because he was always defending some innocent person who was caught in the system.
The state is saying your motive for killing Side Mark was your belief that he killed your protege, Barry Conrad.
And you're trying to tell me he didn't?
Here was someone who was making sure that justice was done.
I intend to prove he did, and I intend to clear his name.
At the same time, my parents were friends with a bunch of young lawyers from the Legal Aid Society in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they were sort of the real-life Perry Mason. They were all incredibly, you know, attractive and vibrant and energetic, and they could talk to me about going to law school and about becoming a lawyer. My goal was to make a difference, to really help people and to really help clean up the system and make the system do what it's supposed to do, help America be what it's supposed to be. In 1973, I was a senior in high school, and my mother took me to see the movie The Paper Chase. Paper Chase is about a student, John Hart.
My name's Hart. Came to ask you to join my study group.
The Hart character is a young man from the Midwest who comes to Harvard and encounters in his first class, which is contracts, with Professor Kingsfield. And Kingsfield is in the business of making lawyers, that a normal human being looks at an issue of justice, of right and wrong, and that these issues really are irrelevant. It's really about what does the law say? How can the law be manipulated?
Mr. Hart, it's obvious that notice is not important here. The offer requires no notice. It requires no personal communication.
And what is throughout the movie, what you see is this transformation of this sort of young, idealistic Midwesterner becoming more sort of ground into the system and senses of right and wrong and good and bad get quickly washed away.
I failed. I worked so hard on that goddamn paper. Well, he may flunk me!
They finally got you, didn't they, Hart? They sucked all that Midwestern charm right out of you.
He encounters Kingsfield's daughter, and they start a romance.
Look, he's got you scared to death. Oh, you're going to pass because you're the kind the law school wants.
You know, she confronts him and says, you've been in a paper chase all your life, your high school diploma, your college diploma, now your law degree.
Your piece of paper that's no different than this, and you can stick it in your silver box with all the other paper in your life. Your birth certificate, your driver's license, your marriage license, your stock certificates, and your will.
As if this, okay, your life's over. This is the death of you.
Susan?
Excuse me.
She's saying, you can be a man or you could be a lawyer. And I was buying into the movie and hoping he'd go with her, hoping that he would turn away from and not be so indoctrinated, that this was something that I probably don't want to do, that I don't want to think like that. But I wasn't going to make a decision based on a movie, and so I needed to do more research and I needed to find out. And I wound up speaking with one of these legal aid lawyers that I had gotten to know who had become a professor. And he explained to me that the movie was pretty much dead on and that lawyers are mostly people who help write contracts, who help people who have money make more money, and you know, the Perry Masons of the world don't really make a living because the little guy who is trapped in the system doesn't have the money to pay you. And so if you're going to make a living at it, you have to, in a sense, be that Kingsfield. You have to be that cog in the machine. And I decided that isn't what I want it to be. And now I'm a professor of communication studies here at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And most of the things I teach are in the realm of how people talk to each other, how they work in organizations, how they work in groups. I teach classes in interviewing and small group communication. And, you know, my students can take what I'm teaching them and really make things better for themselves. A lot of them first-generation students, a lot of them from lower-income families. And this is really a good leg up for them. They come back afterwards and say, you know, you helped me in my job interview and I negotiated a better paycheck for myself, or in some way that really is kind of a marvelous feeling, and that's been very gratifying for me. I don't know if I found justice, but I think I'm at least helping the little guy.
Jonathan Amsbary listens to our show in Birmingham, Alabama on WBHM. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with help from Mooj Zadie. If some TV show or movie or book or other cultural artifact ever changed your life, let us know at studio360.org, and we may ask you to tell your story on the air. Coming up, the filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer wanted to document a period of vast government murders in Indonesia, so he went to the source. And when he asked the members of the death squads to explain themselves, they did the unimaginable. They proudly, gleefully reenacted their crimes for his camera.
It's the unmasking of the whole regime, so it's both terribly moving but also cathartic and joyful, because finally, the regime is showing its true rotten logic.
The incredible documentary The Act of Killing is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Documentaries about mass political killings pretty much always follow a formula. Archival footage, some talking heads, harrowing testimony from victims, the perpetrators either denying or apologizing for the evil they've committed. You know how you're supposed to react, and you do. But the documentary The Act of Killing does without all of those conventions. It's about Indonesia's anti-communist massacres in the 1960s, which killed maybe a million people. And it is told entirely from the perspective of its unpunished, unrepentant perpetrators. The filmmaker, Joshua Oppenheimer, asked death squad leaders to recreate their tortures and murders for his cameras. The result is a surreal, disturbing, deeply thought-provoking film within a film. It's an astonishing, one-of-a-kind documentary, and Oppenheimer has just released a sequel, The Look of Silence, in which one of the victim's brothers finds and talks to some of the murderers. When Oppenheimer started work on these projects, he wasn't sure what he'd find, but he knew he didn't want to make a conventional documentary in The Act of Killing.
I'm not sure I know how to make a more conventional film, but the film would have had a more conventional point of view in the sense that we would have seen the killings, heard about the killings through the eyes of the survivors. But every time I would film with the survivors, we would be stopped. The military would come and stop us. They would take our equipment. They would arrest us. They would detain us. And it was very difficult to get anything done. And so we went back to the Indonesian human rights community with the survivors with whom I was working and said, is it a good idea to make this film? Can we make this film? Is it too soon? Is it too sensitive? Is it too dangerous? Everybody said, no, you're on to something extremely important. We need a film that exposes for Indonesians themselves the nature of this regime, the kind of normality built atop a mass grave, so that Indonesians themselves can stop denying what they already know to be the case, essentially creating the space for Indonesians themselves to start talking about what really happened and the consequences of that for the present.
Because there have been no reconciliation commissions as in, for instance, South Africa.
Oh, exactly, because the men who've done it are still in power.
Well, and so once you decided talking to the survivors is proving impossible, had you already talked to these now elderly perpetrators and already won their confidence?
When I was working with the survivors, they would occasionally send me on these sort of missions to film, meet perpetrators who they thought would talk to me, who they suspected had killed their relatives. So I was sent on these quite painful missions. And when I would meet these perpetrators, they would boast invariably.
Really?
Yeah, I would walk.
So that wasn't just the few you put in the film. This was their standard MO.
Exactly. And then once it was impossible to continue with the survivors, too difficult, too dangerous, then one of the main survivors with whom I was working said, Josh, continue to film the perpetrators. They will boast like the ones you've already met. They will appear to be proud, as though intuiting that they may not really be proud. And in their boasting, the audience will see exactly why we're so afraid and the nature of this regime. So from that point on, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across the region. And they were all boastful. They were all eager to tell me what they've done. And not just that, they would say, I guess you want to see where I did it. And they would take me to the places where they killed, show me how they'd gone about it, launch into these spontaneous demonstrations.
Which must have been amazing when it first happened. Like, I can't believe I'm getting this.
Yeah, at first it was totally shocking. And I felt as though I'd been entrusted by the survivors to gather information of world historical importance. We're talking about the deaths of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people in one province, and no one had ever documented it before.
And at what point did you come up with this idea of them reenacting in this Hollywood-y way the various scenes of their brutality and killings?
Well, before I met the main character, Anwar, when I was still working my way across the countryside, I was already saying to people very openly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. Your whole society's based on it. Your lives are shaped by it. You want to show me what you've done in these simple demonstrations. Show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. I will film the process, film the demonstrations to try and understand what this means to you and your society. So I was quite open. The method was very much we would shoot a scene, screen it for Anwar and his friends, and they would think about what to shoot next. So you can liken the method to a man painting his own portrait, and he paints a little, steps back from the canvas, looks, paints a little more. And I think maybe the core drama of the film comes when he realizes that he can't make a portrait of himself which is at once beautiful and true.
Well, and it makes for this one of the many jaw-dropping moments in this film because it's harrowing to think this is a man who killed people in just this way. Now we're reenacting it in this kind of over-the-top Hollywood-looking way. It's goofy as well as chilling.
I think humor plays a really important role in the film. It's not for some people it's utterly painful, and I think in the end it's painful, but it is a funny film.
And the audience, after a while, frees itself to laugh, sort of.
And I think there's two kinds of humor in the film. Of course, there's these moments of surreal absurdity where you just see a whole regime being unmasked in the most shameless way, and it is absurd and funny, like a scene where Anwar envisions his redemption in heaven, and there waiting for him are his victims with a medal who thank him for killing them and sending them to heaven.
Atas eksekusi yang saudara lakukan terhadap diri saya.
Which is amazing. Now, was that his idea?
That was his idea, and it was a direct response to him having played a victim in a previous scene and felt a kind of trauma.
Well, and this regular screening of essentially not the dailies, but of finished scenes to this guy, this former killer, is extraordinary to watch him and his little grandchildren watching it. But it also, in a journalistic way, as an audience member, I'm thinking the filmmakers didn't lie or trick anybody. He's fully aware of what this film is.
Yeah, that's right. You know, every reenactment, every dramatization implied a denial of the moral meaning of what he had done. I mean, you can't make a cowboy scene about hundreds of people being killed and not be in denial of the true meaning of that action. And so to make the scene was a kind of insistence on that denial. And then I would screen the material back wondering if Anwar might recognize some of the things of which he was in denial in the kind of mirror of the movie. And each time, I think he would, but he wouldn't have yet the courage to know to express that, and he would displace it into the next scene. And so it wasn't a surprise, ultimately. In hindsight, it's not surprising that the fiction scenes themselves, which I saw as these kind of allegories for impunity, ultimately became this kind of prism through which he would somehow confront his broken self.
And he seems finally, in one particular scene, to do that in a very, he gets emotional way. Having spent so much time with him going through this process, did you feel this is real? He's not playing me in some way?
Yeah, I knew at the very end it's real, but there's a moment just before it becomes real where he is really playing, where he says, I think in desperation, when he's finally forced to confront what he's done, he offers this kind of generic confession where he says, now I feel what my victims feel, don't I? And of course, if I said yes then, it would reassure him that what his victims went through was no worse than being in a movie. And I I'm very grateful that at that moment there was nothing technical like lighting or sound to distract me, and I could just be in my heart and listen to him and be present and say, no, of course you're not feeling what your victims felt, because what they went through was so much, much, much worse.
Which is about the only time you speak in the film at length, and it's and has all the more power for it.
And I think in that moment somehow the bottom drops out for him and he's forced to gaze into the abyss, the unbridgeable abyss between all the unimaginable horror that he's put people through and all the stories he's told himself, all the lies that he and the whole regime has told itself to run away from what they've done. It's interesting, you asked this question or you mentioned about Anwar seeing the film, knowing about the film. His reaction to the finished film was very interesting. Of course, he knew what was in it, so he knew it would be a painful experience to watch. For quite a while, he would say, I would say it's nearly finished. I want to show it to you because it's going to come out soon. He would say, I'm not ready to see it because maybe later, maybe later. Finally, I said to him, look, it's out. I have to tell you what's in it. You haven't wanted to see it. Then he found himself at the center of a very big news story in Indonesia. The film has made an enormous impact there. And he said, I need to see the film. So by then it was unsafe. I could no longer go to Indonesia safely. I could probably get in but would never get out again. I arranged for him to go to a place where there'd be good internet connection. I didn't know if I could bring him out of the country because he was now in the news as a mass killer. So we brought him to a place where I could be with him through the screening by Skype. And we sat together. He could talk to me throughout the screening. And at the end of the screening, he sat in this kind of stunned silence for a long time, tearful. Then he said, this film shows what it's like to be me. And it's an honest film, and I'm glad I was able to be so honest. And I will stand by the film. And it was a strange thing to say, except if you remember that he may come under real pressure to denounce the film.
Has it been seen widely in Indonesia, been released?
On the 10th of December, International Human Rights Day last year, they held 50 screenings in 30 cities, and that's grown exponentially since then. So the screenings range in size from 30 to 600 people. By the 1st of April, there had been 500 screenings in 95 cities, and every week there's more than the previous week. But perhaps most gratifying has been the Indonesian news media. So, for example, Indonesia's leading news magazine, Tempo, published a special double edition about the film in which they gathered 75 pages of boastful testimony from killers all around the country, showing that basically the act of killing is a repeatable experiment, that there's tens of thousands of Anwars around the country.
Really? So this that's a happy ending, because it seems as though this film has sort of unlocked the silence.
Yeah, I think the film, it's not the only thing to be sure, but it has helped catalyze a sea change in how Indonesians talk about their past. It's like the child from The Emperor's New Clothes, pointing at the king and saying, look, the king is naked. And everybody knew it, but was too afraid to say it. And now that it's been said so emotionally by the perpetrators themselves, there's no going back. And Indonesians, therefore, are talking for the first time openly and without fear to a degree, because the film has open the way, and it's certainly the best part of completing the film.
And yet, as I've said from the beginning, it is this bizarre work of art. It is not at all the medicinal, earnest kind of documentary that listeners may think, yeah, I don't want to see that. It's in its powerful, strange, disturbing way, it's incredibly entertaining.
I think, in fact, that's why it's having the effect that it's having. You know, I talked about humor earlier. There's, I think, when Indonesians see these moments which we find absurd, crazy, for them it's the unmasking of the whole regime. So it's both terribly moving but also cathartic and joyful, because finally the regime is showing its true rotten logic.
Well, I encourage everyone to go see it. Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much.
It was a great conversation. Thank you.
Joshua Oppenheimer's follow-up to The Act of Killing is called The Look of Silence, and it's now playing in dozens of cities across the country. You can find out where at studio360.org.
And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramosferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Dasha Lisitsina,
Jack DeSidoro.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time on Studio 360, after 50 years in show business, Lily Tomlin says she knows one big thing.
Just barrel through life with all the audacity you can. You'll pay for it, probably, but go ahead and do it.
The brilliant career of the audacious Lily Tomlin. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.